Bristol. Community FM 93.2. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station run almost entirely by volunteers and is here to give the community of Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Are the final chess pieces being put in place across Europe ready for World War III? We ask, who controls the so-called experts now taking over European governments? And the so-called Broadmead bomber was dramatised on BBC Three this week, but how accurate was the interpretation? And also a rare treat for all those that work in Filton, up at BAE Systems and MOD Procurement, on the day the Ministry of Defence announced it's lost 500 computers and hard drives. Former South African MP and one of the world's experts on the global arms trade, who was down talking at Four's Bookshop this week, blows the lid on the widespread criminality and bribery in the arms trade. And also Christmas presents to thwart the forces of darkness. No, not talking about the Lord of the Rings, but everyone's got that. But three thinking man or woman's Christmas books and DVD gift tips. So, first of all, before all that though, we've got Mark Shepherd is in here from the Immigration Advisory Service, which was closed earlier this year without a buy your leave. So, hi Mark, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi Tony, good to be here.
Can you just tell us, take us through how you found out that the Immigration Advisory Service was closing, and just give us an idea of when this happened?
Sure thing. Well, it closed in July this year, it's about 4 months ago. I found out with my colleagues through the cleaner on Friday evening when the cleaners told us that they weren't coming back in on Monday because they weren't going to be paid. So that was the first inkling we had. Then I popped off down the M4 to see my mum and dad and got a text message on the way. The landlord had turned up with a bag of red tape and a couple of bailiffs, and they were repossessing the office.
So was it just one office here in Bristol? Because there are lots of other offices around other parts of the country.
That's right. Yeah. There was one office in Bristol, down in Old Market. There were about 14 countrywide, about 300 employees all told, about 8,000 cases. We had 400 open cases in Bristol at the time.
400 cases you were working on, because you yourself are a lawyer, so I would imagine if you're being treated like that, your lawyer's instinct would kick in and you think, hang on a minute, is that legal?
Well, I mean, like, it's just one of those situations, isn't it? The trustees, it was a charity, the trustees just called in the administrators. They just took over Friday night. Saturday morning, they pinned a notice on the door. Everybody lost their jobs. We are now taking unfair dismissal claims through the tribunal. That takes maybe a year. In the meantime, we're all out of work, and all these guys have got no lawyer.
Now, some might think that this is a sort of LibCon policy, because they are quite anti-immigration, that they just pulled the rug out from under you. So how did it actually happen financially that the trustees of the Immigration Advisory Service couldn't carry on?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all happened really secretively. So us down, you know, at the shop front level, we weren't really told anything. But, you know, the stories that have come out are that that the government was asking for a clawback of £2 million, that, you know, the changes in the legal aid system had just made the whole thing unviable, and that, you know, particularly trying to run a large office in somewhere like London, there just wasn't the money there anymore, and then we just got dragged down into the whole mess of the big in the big cities.
But ultimately, it's a political decision. People have voted for the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. Part of that policy is getting more tough on immigration than the Labour Party. Aren't you just simply a victim of the way the people voted in the general election?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly say that you know, the legal aid bill, which is going through the House of Commons at the moment, is going to totally abolish all forms of legal aid for immigration. So there's clear government policy to strip the people who most need legal aid, to take that away from them. And this is just one, I think, one stage in that process.
Can you give us an example of one of the cases, or maybe a couple of the cases that you were dealing with, without necessarily naming names, but give us an idea of what kind of work you were doing? Yeah. And the sorts of people that you were aiding through your work at the Immigration Advisory Service?
Yeah, sure. So there were two types of work. There's immigration and there's asylum. Asylum, to start with first, that was mainly dealing with people who were seeking refuge from Somalia, Iraq, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan. People have come here because of conflict in their own countries. But on the other hand, we also worked with a lot of British families, you know, because, you know, let's face it, it's the modern world. Everybody travels. People marry from different cultures. They move here. They've got children. And they've got, you know, just because they're poor doesn't mean they shouldn't have a right to choose where they live and who they live with.
But can you go into a little bit of detail, maybe one of the asylum cases, the sorts of people that you were helping? Because, I mean, it's pretty shocking to hear that there are hundreds of these cases which were suddenly just stopped halfway through.
Yeah, sure. So, the sort of people we're looking at are, say, people from Iraq. There are many people from central and southern Iraq who have been denied asylum in this country, and the government is trying to send them home.
But I mean, surely the conflict's over there now. So, I mean, what's the problem?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, everything's very nice, hunky dory in Iraq. People should go home. The government, you know, I mean, what's the government say? That it's spent so many billions of pounds on that country that it's just politically impossible for it to say that things are not safe in that country. And so it doesn't really matter from their point of view what happens to individuals, send them back. The most important thing from the government point of view is to send out the message that things are okay in Iraq. And the last thing they want really are lawyers arguing the toss, saying actually the UN is saying that it's not safe enough to go back to Iraq. The European Court of Human Rights is saying it's not safe enough to return people to Iraq. So why is the British government trying to put people on planes, land them in Baghdad? When they get to Baghdad, the Baghdad authorities are just sending them back to Britain again, and we're just dancing this merry dance.
Martin, can I just bring you in here, because this is quite serious, isn't it, that people who may be facing persecution in their own countries have suddenly had their cases stopped halfway through?
Well, and the immigration cases as well. It's a classic example of, if I stick my head in the sand, this will all go away. In actual fact, we've got to manage the flow of immigrants and asylum seekers in and out of the country, and you have to have people to do that. And just cutting the people who deal with it doesn't make the problem go away. Those people are still going to be there, and they need to be represented. Who's going to represent them? We don't know. Who's going to look into the case and find? Because some people are economic migrants and need to be sorted out from the asylum seekers and so on. Now that requires somebody to have a look at it and to look at into the cases. And many of the asylum cases I know, many of the people who were refused asylum appeal, and then they succeed because once it's been properly looked into. And the problem for the British government is that they've gone around the world kicking over everybody else's sandcastles, and they get the blowback, and they just don't want to know about it. But these people aren't going to go away. They're still going to be there, aren't they? When they've closed down your office that's trying to deal with the problem, but the problem hasn't gone away. They've just closed down the people dealing with it.
Now, Mark, what are the prospects for those who had their cases dropped halfway through, those hundreds of people out there whose cases you were working on?
Well, I mean, just to follow what's just been said, 50% of cases which are decided by the government are overturned on appeal. Now, without a lawyer there to actually stand up for these people, that means they're just being turned into illegal immigrants. Then they're going underground, and that is just creating a larger black economy. And it's also meaning that's all that tax money is being taken away, because these people are just working underground. So, I mean, the prospects for people who don't have lawyers is just that. They're going to go underground. They're not going to leave the UK because they've got connections in this country. You know, so really,
and nowhere else to go.
Absolutely, and nowhere else to go. I mean, if they're from like Somalia, what are they going to do? I mean, they can't go back there. They can't go back to Iraq. Or what if they've got children in this country? What if they've got a wife or a husband in this country? What are they going to do? Are they just going to leave them just because they'd be made an illegal immigrant by a government which is just like, you know, is making poor decisions?
But this present government has said it's trying to get the numbers of immigration down to something like tens of thousands rather than, you know, hundreds of thousands as they are at the moment.
Yeah, but that's all about the managing the borders. What we're talking about are people already in the UK. And, you know, the people in the UK, they're not going to leave. So you've got two choices, really. You either strip away the legal protection, they go underground, or you allow people to come and see a lawyer, take advice about what their situation is, and then make an informed decision about whether they want to stay or not.
Now, you're saying they go underground, but surely the other alternative is that they get arrested by the Immigration Service and sent back to where they were a country of origin.
Yeah, but I mean, this is also fairly farcical, because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of so-called illegal immigrants reporting to police stations around the UK every week. They're not being arrested and removed. This is just like a massive surveillance system, which is also costing tens of millions of pounds. I mean, even recently, there was a story about the UK Border Agency was doing spot checks on buses in Liverpool. And this wasn't even just, you know, for foreign migrants. This is British citizens being pulled off buses and asked for their ID. I mean, it's just an insane system which is costing a lot of money and is eroding civil liberties.
Well, as someone that's been dealing with immigration for years, are there any fixes? What would you like to see done?
Well, I think, you know, there needs to be a more rational approach, really. I think, you know, when you look at this huge argument that happened at the borders recently and the big spat between the Home Secretary and the Border Agency, the reality was the Border Agency were trying to introduce intelligence-led approaches to managing the borders, and the same thing should happen within the UK. The Border Agency is underfunded, it's undertrained, it's got, you know, you suspect this may possibly be a right-wing agenda, and, you know, and the whole thing is becoming irrational. And, you know, you're better off allowing people to have legal protection, allowing them to have a voice, and you know, and then you can weed out the people who should be here for the people who aren't, who shouldn't be here. Just randomly stopping people and having thousands of people reporting at police stations every week is
so
just not the answer.
For anybody who's listening who might be an illegal immigrant or no illegal immigrants,
yeah,
is there anything that they can do to actually get proper citizenship, or is simply by putting their head above the parapet, is that actually liable to get them arrested, deported or anything like that? What's the actual situation?
Well, I mean, that is the risk, and that is why probably many people are not going to go, and they're not going to call up the Home Office or pop down to their local police station and have a chat about whether or not...
But is there anywhere they can go at the moment?
Well, at the moment, in Bristol, the amount of legal aid available has been severely cut by over 50%. Now, we have set up a new organisation. We are bidding to bring legal aid back to Bristol. That's going to happen at some point next year. Between now and then, there's a black hole. But, you know, we're hoping that towards, you know, the beginning of next year, that there might be an opportunity for people to come back and take advice from people like us. But, you know, overall, in the long term, I'm afraid that legal aid is being cut. And, you know, if you need to write to your MP and protest about this if you want to prevent it happening.
OK, well, Mark Shepherd, a caseworker and lawyer from the Immigration Advisory Service, now defunct, RIP. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thanks, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, The Boarding School Bomber was a docudrama on BBC Three last week, and such programmes are a little bit dangerous because they are wide open. It's a docudrama to twisting and spinning the facts. Martin Summers is with me, and he was watching this docudrama on BBC Three. Martin, can you just take us through it a little bit? This is about Issa Ibrahim, the so-called boarding school bomber, or someone who has been called, rather, I think that's probably the wrong term to use, also called the Broadmead bomber.
Yeah, I did watch the show, and I watch these things expecting to be annoyed. So sometimes I don't watch them because I think, oh, God, I'm just going to be annoyed here and want to kick the television. But in actual fact, it was very sensitively done. They spoke to his family. They spoke to people who knew him. And by and large, the picture painted was an extremely fair one to all concerned. And he's a rather unusual character because he was basically a middle-class kid who went to private school at in the top end of the city and then converted to Islam. His father was Egyptian, but he was from a very kind of safe middle-class background. And then gradually convinced himself by looking at the internet that he was an Al-Qaeda bomber and then set off to be one. And as it happened, he was going to all the mosques around here and trying to stir everybody up. And they realised he was nuts. And after a lot of soul-searching, they tipped the police off and said something will have to be done about him, and they went round and found that he was indeed preparing. The reason they found him is he's building bombs in his house, and he'd blown his hand up, because that's what happens when you're using the unconventional explosives. And of course he went to the mosque and said, I've blown my hand up, and they said, oh right. And of course they then dobbed him in.
So you think it was actually a reasonably well put together docudrama?
Yes, I mean,
sticking to the fact.
He was a very strange individual because he'd been a heroin addict, he'd been a crack addict, he'd been to a posh school. He was a bit of an outsider and a loner. And when he converted himself to Islam, he used to go around all the mosques around here trying to persuade them all that they needed to blow things up. And they were going, you need to think about this, son. You need to learn about Islam. Never mind talking to us about blowing things up. So in actual fact, the good news from a Bristol point of view is that he stuck out like a sore thumb, and he literally did have a sore thumb, and at that point he was nabbed. But I mean, it's very sad really, because he was only a young guy and he's ruined his whole life, and he's got 10 years now. He's recanted his previous lifestyle. He's now actually properly Islamic. And his mother, who was very upset, was saying at the end, I've just had a little card from him saying, I've just been listening to a tape about obedience to parents, and I'd just like to apologise to you and Dad for everything I've done and what disgrace I've brought on the family. So in prison, he seems to be actually beginning to understand Islam properly. And I think Sadiq was on the programme, who's used to head up Bristol Muslim Cultural Society. He was very articulate, as he always is, and he was talking about the decision to shop him and how the community, you know, soul-searched about that, because they knew that it would cause bad publicity and so on. But they shopped him, and they were right to do so.
But there is a certain pattern here, isn't there, in that some of the people who've been put forward as, sort of dangerous terrorists are more kind of basket cases. I mean, yeah. Here we've got a heroin addict, for example.
Yeah, ex-heroin addict. So he's kicked the habit, and he became a Muslim as part of kicking the habit, and then got the wrong end of the stick, as he had about other things. What was interesting is he got it all off the internet, and it wasn't made clear in the film whether he'd just been looking at websites or whether people had been whispering to him on the internet and saying, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? Because this is what I suspect, is that the intelligence services are manipulating these kind of people to carry out these kind of acts so that they can aggrandise power to themselves. We mentioned Harood Rashid Aswat earlier, named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of 7-7, now in preventive detention because the Americans have dressed him up as an MI6 double agent.
Well, there was also that report in The Guardian last week, wasn't there, about the FBI, actually all of the operations going on in the US being sting operations.
Yes, virtually every terrorist that's been put down in the US, it's on a sting operation. The people they target are the lost, the lonely, the confused, the semi-criminal. And in actual fact, if you look at the profile of IRA terrorists, they're not those kind of people at all. They're very cool customers.
Now, the French English language channel France 24 last week, had an interesting piece about Goldman Sachs. Yet more evidence that this New York-based investment bank really does rule the world. And we heard on the BBC World a few weeks ago an independent trader saying exactly that. So let's have a listen to an extract from the French English language channel France 24 and their weekly media review.
It's time now for Media Watch. James Creedence here. We have a bit of controversy on our hands tonight, don't we? Le Monde's London correspondent claims that Goldman Sachs has developed a network of influential figures across Europe, which includes the new head of the European Central Bank.
It's pretty extraordinary stuff. Page 2 of Le Monde today, the European Freemasonry of Goldman Sachs. And what they mean by Freemasonry is the way in which the Freemasons operate is it's a network. Mm-hmm. And Goldman Sachs essentially, according to the London correspondent, I mean, it's pretty difficult to refute what he says, have put in place a network across Europe. Who does that include? You've got Mario Draghi. He's the new head of the European Central Bank, former vice president of Goldman Sachs Europe. You've also got the current Prime Minister, unelected Prime Minister of Italy, that's Mario Monti. He was a former advisor to Goldman Sachs from, I think, 2005 up until the point when he was made Prime Minister. You've also got the Prime Minister of Greece by the name of Loukas Papademos. And he was a former head of the Greek Central Bank at the time when Greece came into the Eurozone. Now, what they're saying here is the figures that Greece presented with were not honest. It seems that Goldman Sachs helped Greece to present a better face to the world through very complicated financial instruments known as swaps. This was a financial instrument that Goldman Sachs helped Greece to conceal its debt with.
That's since been referred to as lies and manipulation by various observers since, hasn't it?
But what's extraordinary is that the Greek Central Bank was, I suppose, complicit with Goldman Sachs in concealing the true extent of Greek debt. And you had Loukas Papademos at the head of the Greek Central Bank at that time. And he goes through various other figures. You've also got this guy, a former European commissioner, an Irish man by the name of Peter Sutherland. He helped to place Mario Monti, who is now the Prime Minister, at the head of the Trilateral Commission, according to Le Monde. That's a key inner circle for the global elite. So what you're seeing here in this article is a list of names of people who have very close associations with Goldman Sachs, who have very senior positions, either in central banks or at government level in several different European countries.
So Goldman Sachs, Freemasons, all linked together, and Le Monde basically going public on it and saying
Le Monde going public on the whole thing. And what's interesting is their London correspondent, a guy by the name of Mark Rush, he wrote a book called The Bank, How Goldman Sachs Rules the World. Now, it won the French Business Book Award in 2010.
You know, his reputation is good.
Absolutely.
No, he's not crazy.
And he goes into great length of this article, which is well worth reading for those who do read French, saying that since 1986, Goldman Sachs has been extending into the European market, of course, originally an American bank, and they have targeted former European commissioners and former managers at central banks throughout Europe to work on their behalf. And they often don't tell the people who they're dealing with that they are actually associated with Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs then allegedly has access to information which is favourable. James Creighton, as ever.
Thanks, Mark.
With Media Watch.
That was an extract there from the English language France 24 TV channel. Martin, the European Freemasonry of Goldman Sachs. That's the English translation of an article in Le Monde last week.
Well, Goldman Sachs are the heart of darkness, really. They are the dark side. They're not the only hedge fund on the planet, but by goodness, they're certainly the biggest and nastiest. And they've bought the politics in the US. They now control Italy and Greece. People are going to wake up and suddenly realise who these guys are. Many of them are fraudsters. They've bought the political process. It's time for these people to be cut down to size.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, on now to our three Christmas gift tips item. Last week we had a terrific author, Anthony Hall, on talking about his book Earth into Property. So that's tip number one, which would make a wonderful Christmas gift if you know someone who actually chooses what they read rather than waits for someone else to give them information via TV or radio. So that's a great Christmas book idea. We also have, at last, the release on DVD of the first season of the BBC's long-awaited and very popular 80s drama series shot right here in Bristol called Shoestring. It follows a radio detective called Eddie Shoestring, played by Trevor Eve, who quits his job in computers to work as a so-called private ear in and around Bristol at some sort of fictional radio station looking rather like Radio Bristol. And aficionados have been waiting for nearly 20 years for the release of this on DVD, and it's thought the Series 2 will be out for next Christmas. But you won't be getting it in HMV, so I just popped in there to see if they had it. For some reason, no, not in Bristol. It seems it's quite difficult to buy the series on the high streets of Bristol. You may have to get that online. Now on, though, to today's final Christmas choice for the discerning reader. Here's a rare treat for all those who work in Filton at BAE Systems or MOD Procurement. And today, the Ministry of Defence announced it had lost 500 computers and hard drives. But the former South African MP, one of the world's experts at the global arms trade, is about to blow the lid right now on the widespread criminality and bribery in the arms trade. Right, well, I'm joined by Andrew Feinstein now. Andrew, what is your book entitled?
The book is called The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. And it really is a study, the first in probably over two decades, of the global trade in weapons and how it functions and how it impacts on our politics.
Because one of the modern things we're having to come across nowadays, particularly, is that war is good for business.
Well, exactly. It was. I mean, it's not even today. Henry Ford, the industrialist, commented that show me who makes a profit from war and I'll show you how to stop the war. So I think this is something that's been going on for ages. I think what has happened recently, though, is that the focus on the war business has really moved. And part of the motivation of writing this book is to refocus attention on the trade in conventional arms and the sorts of impact it has on corroding democracy, undermining accountability, undermining the rule of law, and the ways in which the so-called formal trade, the government-to-government trade, interacts with and in some ways is mutually dependent with what I call the grey or black markets in arms, the shadow world of the arms business. So you find the Russian arms dealer, sometimes known as the merchant of death, Victor Boot, who was convicted a few weeks ago in a New York court of gun running to the FARC guerrillas in Colombia. Between 2003 and 2005, Boot made tens of millions of dollars running equipment, weapons, and ammunition into Baghdad for the U.S. Department of Defense. And what the book tries to show is how these sorts of relationships are very common.
So the idea with Boot, for example, is that maybe he kind of switched sides, or else somebody decided that he wasn't the right guy to be doing this sort of business anymore.
Well, I think the issue is that a lot of these guys have very close links to governments. They are often used as intelligence assets. And, yeah, you know, morality isn't high on their priority list here. So, I mean, Boot and hundreds of others like him, if not thousands, are happy to sell to all sides in all conflicts, regardless of embargoes, etc., etc. And sometimes, yeah, you know, there'll be an intelligence asset for one group, but they'll also be arming the enemies of those groups, if you will. And at times in the US and other countries, they decide enough is enough, and someone they've used, they then bring them in. But unfortunately, when that happens, as has happened in the case of Boot, the full story never comes out. I mean, the Boot trial was very narrowly focused on the sting operation that netted him, which was in relation to this one transaction with FARC. And very little mention was made of his work for the US and his links into the US government. So the book is trying to go behind the veil of secrecy that is imposed by the needs of national security, as it's coined, to show the true face of this business and how damaging I believe it is for our democracies.
Now, Martin Summers is with me too. Martin, this is potentially quite worrying at a stage where we're in an economic crisis. Do you think it's fair to say that the economic crisis, certainly in the West anyway, is likely to make people more dependent on the arms and the arms trade, and maybe a bit more desperate for arms?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. The super committee that's about to report in the United States tomorrow is not going to probably agree to reduce the deficit. And the main sticking point is that the Republicans won't accept any cuts in military expenditure. So that's their attitude towards economic crisis. And there is also a similar delusion somehow that military spending keeps the economy going. Whereas I would suggest that the US needs to stop military spending and start spending stuff on its own people. That would be a much more sensible use of their own money.
Well, the interesting thing about that is I would argue that the US defense sector contributed to the fiscal crisis that the US
Absolutely.
Finds itself in. You know, we have a country that is spending over $1 trillion a year on national security, with a defense budget of over $703 billion a year. Now, at a time when ordinary Americans' basic human security is under threat, like probably no time since the 1930s, they are still, because of the circle of patronage that is the domestic procurement system in the US, they are producing a jet fighter, something called the F-35, that is going to cost the American taxpayer a minimum of $382 billion for a jet that might have been useful during the Cold War, is largely irrelevant to the sorts of conflicts the US finds itself engaged in today. But I believe that the vested interests are so strong between military officials, the defense contractors, and lawmakers, that they're prepared to do these things. And the people who suffer the consequences are not only those at the receiving end of the weaponry, but also ordinary American taxpayers who are having to foot the bill for this stuff.
In Britain, we're building an aircraft carrier, but we're not going to have any planes on it. And BAE Systems basically said that, you know, they were lined up to build the damn thing, and they said if we don't get paid to you'll break our contract with us if you cancel it. So the government was in a position where they couldn't cancel it,
yeah,
but they didn't have any money for the planes. So we're building an aircraft carrier which will have no planes. I mean, how nuts is this?
It's absolutely farcical, but it also shows the role of BAE Systems in the British economy and British political,
yeah,
life, which I experienced firsthand when I was an ANC Member of Parliament in South Africa shortly after democracy came to the country, when, very sadly, as Nelson Mandela was about to step down from public life, his successor Thabo Mbeki drove a process whereby South Africa entered into an arms deal that will land up costing the country something around £6 billion. For weapons that South Africa has never needed, that the country barely uses today. And who was at the forefront of that? BAE Systems.
It's like the thing in Tanzania where they made them take a military air traffic control system.
Absolutely.
Which they didn't need and was not suitable for their needs, but they were told, you know, your aid budget's going to be cut off unless you sign up for this.
Absolutely. And driving all of these deals is the British government. I mean, Tony Blair made 3 visits to South Africa to promote the BAE, and it was a joint venture with Saab, the BAE Saab option on this on this deal. It was beyond farcical. 9 countries bid for this contract to build a fighter trainer jet for South Africa. BAE and Saab offered a separate trainer and fighter jet. So the Minister of Defense in South Africa at the time changed the technical criteria, because BAE Saab hadn't made an initial technical shortlist, so that separate planes were now wanted, whereas the original tender had been for one that could be used both to train and to fight. And still, because they were 2.5 times more expensive than the option that the Air Force actually wanted, BAE Saab were third on a shortlist of 3 when the defense minister insisted that they be placed on the shortlist. So he then decided on the single most expensive contract that the Democratic South Africa has ever signed to exclude cost as a procurement criteria. They still weren't in first place. So he then changed the weighting on another procurement criteria, economic or industrial offsets, which in my opinion are just so much economic sophistry, which is where these companies, especially in the defense sector, say that for every $100 of equipment you buy from us, we'll invest 120 or whatever it is dollars into your economy. And of course these things are never delivered, but they're a very good way for politicians to justify why they engage in these arms deals. And surprise, surprise, BAE Saab landed up getting the contract, and £115 million of bribes were paid to the defense minister, his political advisor, to the head of procurement in the defense force, and I'm sad to say, to my own political party itself, the ANC. When I was re-elected to government in 1999 in our second election, the campaign was contested with the funds from the successful bidders on that arms deal.
But that's one of the problems we've got in the world today, is that politics does require money, and therefore these are the people with the money. And even genuine politicians require genuine political money, apart from bribes, don't they?
Absolutely. And I mean, at the root of a lot of these problems is party political financing. And in the South African case, any donation to a political party remains secret. There is no requirement to reveal anything about where a party raises its funding from. And at the ANC's last triennial congress, when Jacob Zuma was elected president 10 days after 783 counts of corruption, fraud and racketeering were dropped 10 days before he was elected by an acting prosecutor who, a few weeks after the election, was made an acting high court judge, in that instance, we had a situation where we had no idea where any of the money that was funding a party that announced that it had a surplus of over 1.2 billion South African rands without presenting any financial accounts. The treasurer just stood up and announced this fact. And no investigations of where this money had come from. And the reality is that the arms deal, which Tony Blair and BAE Systems were pushing harder than anybody else, was really the point at which the ANC lost its moral compass, where the sort of quite transparent, quite accountable form of governance that had been instituted after 1994 started falling apart and led from one corruption scandal to another, to the point where even the country's deputy president, Halima Motlanthe, said just over a month ago, both the ANC and the South African government at all levels is drowning in a sea of corruption.
But Andrew, surely this kind of thing could never happen in Britain.
Well, you know, from my research for this book, and I've been working on these issues now for over 11 years, since I started investigating this deal in South Africa, the reality to me is that BAE Systems, and therefore the United Kingdom, outside of China and Russia, are probably the most problematic of all countries and arms companies in the way they operate in the international arms export market.
Well, we had Mark Thatcher and the Yamama deal. Could you just describe that briefly?
Well, absolutely. To some known as the Who's Yamama deal, when it became apparent that Mark Thatcher, son of the then Prime Minister, earned £12 million from that deal as an agent. This hold-all category that is used by the arms industry around the world to identify those who act as the conduits for the bribes. And the extraordinary thing about the Al Yamama deal is it was the biggest ever arms deal worth, it is estimated, around £48 billion. And the Metropolitan Police estimated that £6 billion of commissions were paid on that deal. Now, in one instance, payments of just over £1 billion were made to the Saudi ambassador to the United States at the time, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, whose father happened to be the Saudi defense minister at the time. And, you know, some of these were paid through this very complex offshore network focused mainly on the British Virgin Islands. But a significant amount of that money actually went from the Bank of England to Bandar's accounts in a bank called Riggs Bank in Washington, D.C., which was this venerable institution that had been banker to presidents, ambassadors, etc., etc., for decades and decades. And Riggs was only investigated when it turned out that some money had flowed from the account of Bandar's wife with the same bank into the accounts of two of the 9/11 hijackers. Then an investigation was started. The commissions, the bribes, that didn't start the investigation. It was the national security dimensions of it. And just in case that wasn't sufficient for Prince Bandar, he was also given the gift of an Airbus plane for his own private and personal use that was painted in the colors of his favorite American football team, the Dallas Cowboys. That is probably the most corrupt transaction in trading history. But it is worth bearing in mind that it is estimated that the arms trade accounts for around 40% of all corruption in all global trade. And we in the United Kingdom and in the United States, where they're about to enter into an arms deal worth $60 billion with the selfsame Saudis, are at the center of the corruption in this trade.
Now, we also saw, after the fall of Mubarak, a sort of rather hasty trade trip right round the Middle East from David Cameron and various arms representatives. That, on the face of it, looks like the possibility of cashing in on potential unrest that had happened up until then and also into the future. But why do you think these are so necessary, these arms trips like that?
Well, if you ask my opinion, they're not necessary at all. All they bring with them is instability, but they make a lot of money for the arms companies. And according to the sort of discourse of the industry, which I believe is deeply flawed, they create tens of thousands of jobs, and I think the numbers are hugely inflated. I think the jobs that they do create are incredibly expensive jobs. A lot of the jobs that they claim to create aren't even in the countries they claim they're in. But the reality of the Arab Spring situation is, you know, we had Obama in the case of Egypt praising those who had brought about the overthrow of Mubarak. The U.S. from 1981, when Mubarak came to power, in fact from before then when he was head of the Air Force, had actually been supplying him with weapons on such a huge scale. They provided just over $21 billion worth of weaponry to Egypt from 1981 until a few months ago when he was overthrown. And the reality is that that did two things. It made him an incredibly wealthy man because he took a personal cut on all of those deals, and it kept him in power. And then we had David Cameron with all of the arms industry executives claiming how proud he was of Britain's role in the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. He failed to mention the £120 million of weapons that Britain had sold to Gaddafi since 2005, since his so-called rehabilitation in the eyes of the West. Again, weaponry that he had used to stay in power, that had been used against the rebels fighting him. And the ultimate irony, when the NATO bombing started, what did they first have to do? They had to destroy the weaponry that NATO member countries, including the United Kingdom, had sold to Gaddafi. So the double standards, the hypocrisy to make the arms trade just drives me insane.
Now, that's actually good for business, isn't it? If you can sell something to somebody and then destroy it, then it's going to create even more of a demand for your product.
Sure, but the question that has to be asked, while it might be good for business, the question is it good for the rest of us? And, you know, without trying to appropriate language that we've seen in some of the Occupy movements recently, what about the other 99% of us who don't benefit from these sorts of deals? And the fact that what this is doing is, just as happened in the case of South Africa, is getting countries that can ill afford it at huge social cost to themselves let alone the sorts of conflicts that it is perpetuating, what it costs these countries in social terms and what it costs us as taxpayers. Because we should never forget that these are heavily subsidized industries. We had for decades and decades in the United Kingdom the Export Credit Guarantee Scheme. So that in these sorts of deals, if the Saudis didn't pay, like happened in one instance with the Indonesians, it would be the British taxpayer who would step in and make sure that BAE and others got their money. So while it might be good for business, I would argue that it probably isn't very good for the societies we're selling to, or even for ourselves.
You're talking about all these big weapons systems, you know, very expensive stuff. I used to work for Amnesty International a few years ago, and one of the campaigns they were running was about small arms going around the world. And in actual fact, small arms get used. Very much so. I mean, these white elephant aircraft carriers with no aircraft on are clearly pointless. You know, missile defence systems don't work. They're just very expensive boondoggles. But a lot of the most dangerous arms dealing is of small arms, which of course do get used. I mean, the world is awash with small arms. And as the banks go down and social conflicts increase, they're there waiting to be used inside the United States itself, never mind the rest of the world. Sure.
Well, you have a situation, let me just pick up on one point just relating to the Arab Spring again, and then I'll come onto small arms again. The other sort of unintended consequence, the so-called blowback of this sort of stuff, is that a lot of the weaponry that we sold to Gaddafi and others, which was the sophisticated stuff and a whole lot of smaller arms, we sold him so many stuff that he actually didn't have the military personnel to utilize a whole lot of it, and it was put away in warehouses. It was stockpiled in warehouses that obviously during the transition were unguarded, and we're already seeing that a lot of that equipment is starting to appear on the world's black markets in weapons, so that somebody with $50,000 to spare can go and buy themselves a surface-to-air missile system that can take down a commercial jet. And they do that by wandering off to the periphery of Egypt and Libya, which is another consequence of our engagement in some of these areas. But in terms of small arms, in numerical terms, you're talking about around $4 billion a year of what is a $60 billion a year industry. So in those sorts of terms, it's a small part of it. But in terms of the impact that it has on the world in which we live, it is huge. Because as you say, these are used in all sorts of conflicts. They are very easy to transport from place to place. And this is really the black market in arms. And the point I'm trying to make in the book is that, you know, the Victor Boots, the Leonard Minins and all sorts of others who have made fortunes from trading mainly in small and light weapons are as involved in what is supposed to be the clean formal trade. So the two are completely enmeshed in each other. And I think it's very important to bear that in mind. So when we look at, you know, and I obviously, because of my background as a South African, I tend to focus on the African continent and the sorts of impacts that these weapons have had in a range of conflicts across the continent. And when we look at these impacts and the devastation that has been caused, we should never lose sight of the fact that it's not just these illicit arms dealers, but it is the fact that they are supported and often protected by our own governments. And that's what allows this devastation to happen, be it through the small and light weapons which proliferate all over the world, or be it through this big, sophisticated, the so-called white elephant stuff.
Now, Andrew, another aspect to all of this is that we're increasingly seeing that it's not just governments that are purchasing these arms, it's private military companies as well. What's their role nowadays, and how is that changing the world of arms? Yeah.
Well, I think the point to make is that the United States has effectively privatized war. I mean, there's the absurd situation where after 9/11, the U.S. identified as a national security weakness their Coast Guard system. So they had Lockheed Martin, the biggest defense contractor in the world, won a contract worth tens of billions of dollars to supposedly modernize the Coast Guard. It was 10 years before they built the first vessels that they were supposed to have built in 3 or 4. The hulls, as soon as they were put into water, the hulls cracked. But the most extraordinary thing was this contract wasn't even being managed by the Pentagon. It was being managed by another private defense contractor. So you have private companies supposedly providing the oversight of private companies in the name of governments. And surprise, surprise, no oversight is provided. And I think that the consequence of that is that there is very little legal accountability for what happens in the market and in the trade, and there is very little legal accountability for what happens on the battlefield. You know, we have the notorious case of Blackwater, which is effectively a mercenary company, but they've also been involved in the movement and trading of weapons. They're now called Z. They have this sort of postmodern name, XE, now, because they had so many legal difficulties, they decided to start anew. And it was almost impossible for them to be prosecuted in Iraq and Afghanistan because US courts had ruled that they did not have jurisdiction over anything that happened in those conflict zones involving the employees of this company. And the Americans ensured that the Iraqi and Afghani governments were not allowed to take any of these people to court. So you had Blackwater employees involved in a massacre in a marketplace in Iraq, for instance, where 18 completely innocent civilians were gunned down for no other reason than it seemed as though these employees were drunk and on something of a spree. And there was absolutely no legal accountability for this. And then, when the government of, I can't remember whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan, about a year and a half ago, wanted to throw this company out of their country, President Obama intervened and said they simply couldn't do that because the US military was so dependent on what is a mercenary force. So we have this absurd situation with the privatization of war where accountability has been removed, where any sort of legal recourse has been removed, and these companies can effectively do what they want. And the bottom line is, who pays for all of this? Oh yes, it's us, the taxpayer again.
Yeah, well, this is all very interesting. I mean, what about the trade in weapons of mass destruction? You know, I'm thinking now about nuclear weapons, because Armscorn made some nuclear weapons, didn't they? And we're hearing rumours that those weapons were not destroyed and have actually, you know, disappeared onto the international black market.
The first thing I should say is that I've focused my work on conventional arms, so it's not an area on which I'm an authority by any means. But while I was in South Africa during that extraordinary transition period, it was my understanding that we had destroyed most of our nuclear weapons. But I too have come across information that suggests that perhaps that wasn't the case. And when you look at the genesis of how South Africa came to have nuclear weapons, one has to become extremely cautious about what has happened to them now, because the reality is that apartheid South Africa conspired with the State of Israel so that both could produce nuclear weaponry. And these were two states, amongst a number of others, I should add, who really should not have had access to nuclear weaponry. But given the support that was given by the Reagan and Thatcher administrations to apartheid South Africa and to Israel, it shouldn't come as a surprise to us that they work together to produce nuclear capability. So I retain a very open mind on what might have happened to those weapons post the advent of democracy in South Africa.
Andrew, it's a pretty gloomy picture you're painting, particularly the idea of a sort of privatised world of arms dealers and military making money out of misery around the world. What do you think are the sort of key points that need addressing to actually stop this mushrooming up into a kind of capitalist nightmare?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there is an opportunity. And before people get too gloomy, I should just reassert that I'm a great believer in the dictum that I think originated with a not uncontroversial anthropologist, Margaret Mead, who said something along the lines of, it takes a group of thoughtful, committed citizens to change history, and that's the only way it ever has been changed. So I do think that, you know, my motivation for writing these books, and especially this current one on the global trade in arms, is because I do believe that it affects very ordinary citizens who might not realize the impacts that this trade has on their own pockets and their own lives. But that I think we can do something about it. And there is a big opportunity now with something called the International Arms Trade Treaty that's being negotiated at the United Nations. And this is a treaty that could be incredibly weak and simply serve as a rubber stamp of approval for the status quo in the arms trade. Or if we as ordinary citizens are prepared to push our governments, and this is what I'm going around the world talking about at the moment, we could actually make this meaningful. We could insist that there are criteria that are actively enforced around who one cannot sell weapons to. So the obvious human rights criteria, issues around negative impact on socioeconomic development, which was certainly the case in South Africa, where at the time we were spending around £6 billion on weapons. Our president, Thabo Mbeki, was saying we couldn't afford to provide antiretroviral medication to the over 5.5 million South Africans living with HIV or AIDS. And so I think that socioeconomic impacts would be something very important at all. But then we could actually do two very simple things that would fundamentally change the nature of this trade. We could insist on far greater transparency around middlemen, agents or dealers who are used in all of these deals.
These are the kind of wearity characters, possibly.
Well, exactly. Of course they are. You know, on the South African deal, BAE Systems used a guy who, as their main agent, and over £50 million went through this guy's accounts, clearly to be used as payments to the key decision makers. And, you know, this is a guy who is on EU and US financial sanctions list for being a crony of Robert Mugabe's. But BAE Systems were very happy to use him as their covert agent on this deal. And if we simply forced companies and governments to make public who the middlemen are, the agents, the dealers, be they the wearities or whoever else, that they use on these deals, what money they were paid, and what they were being paid for, you would find that all of a sudden, bribery and corruption in the arms trade would become a lot more difficult to do. The second thing is just get rid of the use of economic offsets. The World Trade Organization makes it illegal to use economic or industrial offsets in procurement decisions as procurement criteria in any other sector but the arms trade. But these are where the companies promise that they're going to invest sort of $120 into your economy for every $100 you spend, which, as I said, is so much economic sophistry. You know, the absurdity in South Africa, the Swedish company Saab made about a $3 million investment in a very small tourism destination up the eastern Cape coast of South Africa. The way in which they got credits from the South African government for the so-called offset credits to show they were meeting their obligations was that every Swede who visited South Africa, whether they went anywhere near this tourist destination or not, meant thousands of credits for Saab. So in 2010, when South Africa hosted the Football World Cup, every Swedish football fan who went to South Africa, even if they didn't go within 1,000 miles of the area that Saab had invested in, Saab was getting offset credits for their presence in South Africa. Now, the World Trade Organization has seen that these are a nonsense, which is why they've banned them in procurement decisions in every other sector. I've been unable to get an answer for them as to why they made an exception for the arms trade. But the arms trade treaty could simply stop that exception immediately because they're nothing more than another conduit for bribery.
Okay, well, finally, what would you say to those, I mean, we have just give two examples of people who've been campaigning against the arms trade. One is with landmines, is Princess Diana. The other was Robin Cook, who was the foreign secretary who resigned on principle over the Iraq war.
Yeah.
Both of them are no longer with us. Yeah. Some would say met with unfortunate accidents.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't want to get into conspiracies, but I think it's important to point out that doing work on any of these areas that relates to the arms trade is, one, not a very popular thing to be doing, and two, largely gets kept out of the mainstream media, which again was a motivation for writing this book. You know, there's a reason why, since Anthony Sampson wrote a book called The Arms Bazaar in 1979, there has been no book on the global arms trade. There is a reason for that. And the reason is simply that it's as though the mainstream media is trying to imagine that this industry and this trade, in which our own governments and major companies are so deeply implicated, doesn't exist. Or if it does exist, it only does good. So the crucial thing is to continue to expose this and to exert pressure on our elected representatives and the countries concerned, because if we don't, we're going to continue a pattern where the trade in arms, as is currently structured, continues to make the world a poorer place, a more corrupt place, a less democratic place, and most ironic of all, a more dangerous place.
Andrew Feinstein there speaking to me and Martin earlier this week. And his book is The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade, one of three we're recommending as Christmas gifts this week. The other is the Shoestring DVD. The price, by the way, The Shadow World online is about £17. The Shoestring, the Series 1, which is just out from 1979 on DVD, is £15 online. And finally, it's Anthony J. Hall's book, Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization and Capitalism, which is all about empires since 1492. But Martin, what we just heard there is about the privatisation of war.
Yes, I mean, I think Andrew was one of the most intelligent people I've ever met on these topics. I was very impressed by the fact that he didn't use any notes when he was talking to us, did he?
No, and he said it's 30 years since someone's written a book on the global arms trade. Indeed. That was Anthony Sampson, who's now no longer with us.
And also he's got a massive experience, a very interesting guy. Well, his book's well worth a look, I would suggest.
Well, more on this topic next week and in future weeks, no doubt. But for now, that's it. That's all the serious talk out of the way. It was after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 7. Friday night is Music Night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the French Blood Party crew, followed by Erotic Toast and the UFO Show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Southwest Region UKIP MEP Trevor Coleman. And also to lawyer Mark Shepherd, and as you heard just then from Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan and analysis of Easter's Tesco riots, a report on mobile phones and wireless safety, and evidence of Masonic corruption in the police. Just go to www.thisweek.org.uk, and we've got archives going back the last 2 years, unlike, of course, the BBC. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 65 million people in Britain and 65 million acres of land, so while it might seem there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because banks and big business have hijacked more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 65 million acres is shared out fairly, and with modern technology not controlled by the power elite, we can all live happily together. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. The run up to the Fresh Blood Party. Finally, tonight we have a special song, especially written ahead of time back in 1982, all about the LibCon coalition government's vision for the future ruled by the banks.
UK BCFM News.